Chapter 3. It was 2 in the morning when the dancers, bent on getting something to eat, adjourned the dancing for half an hour. And it was at this moment that Jack Kearns suggested poker. Jack Kearns was a big, bluff-featured man, who, along with Bettles, had made the disastrous attempt to found a post on the head reaches of the Koyukuk, far inside the Arctic Circle. After that, Kearns had fallen back on his posts at 40 mile and 60 mile, and changed the direction of his ventures, by sending out to the States for a small sawmill and a river steamer. The former was even then being sledded across Chilkoot Pass by Indians and dogs, and would come down the Yukon in the early summer after the ice run. Later in the summer, when Bering Sea and the mouth of the Yukon cleared of ice, the steamer, put together at St. Michael's, was to be expected up the river loaded to the guards with supplies. Jack Kearns suggested poker. French Louis, Dan MacDonald, and Al Campbell, who had made a strike on Moosehide, all three of whom were not dancing, because there were not girls enough to go around, inclined to the suggestion. They were looking for a fifth man, when Burning Daylight emerged from the rear room, the Virgin on his arm, the train of dancers in his wake. In response to the hail of the poker players, he came over to their table in the corner. "Want you to sit in," said Campbell. "How's your luck?" "I sure got it tonight," Burning Daylight answered with enthusiasm, and at the same time felt the Virgin press his arm warningly. She wanted him for the dancing. "Sure got my luck with me, but I'd sooner dance. I ain't hankering to take the money away from you all." Nobody urged. They took his refusal as final, and the Virgin was pressing his arm to turn him away in pursuit of the supper seekers, when he experienced a change of heart. It was not that he did not want to dance, nor that he wanted to hurt her, but that insistent pressure on his arm put his free man nature in revolt. The thought in his mind was that he did not want any woman running him. Himself a favorite with women, nevertheless they did not bulk big with him. They were toys, playthings, part of the relaxation from the bigger game of life. He met women along with the whiskey and gambling, and from observation he had found that it was far easier to break away from the drink and the cards than from a woman once the man was properly entangled. He was a slave to himself, which was natural in one with a healthy ego, but he rebelled in ways either murderous or panicky at being a slave to anybody else. Love's sweet servitude was a thing of which he had no comprehension. Men he had seen in love impressed him as lunatics, and lunacy was a thing he had never considered worth analyzing. But comradeship with men was different from love with women. There was no servitude in comradeship. It was a business proposition, a square deal between men who did not pursue each other, but who shared the risks of trail and river and mountain in the pursuit of life and treasure. Men and women pursued each other, and one must needs bend the other to his will or hers. Comradeship was different. There was no slavery about it. And though he, a strong man beyond strength seeming, gave far more than he received, he gave not something due, but in royal largesse, his gifts of toil or heroic effort falling generously from his hands. To pack for days over the gale-swept passes, or across the mosquito-ridden marshes, and to pack double the weight his comrade packed, did not involve unfairness or compulsion. Each did his best. That was the business essence of it. Some men were stronger than others, true, but so long as each man did his best it was fair exchange, the business spirit was observed, and the square deal obtained. But with women, no. Women gave little and wanted all. Women had apron strings, and were prone to tie them about any man who looked twice in their direction. There was the Virgin, yawning her head off when he came in and mightily pleased that he asked her to dance. One dance was all very well, but because he danced twice and thrice with her, and several times more, she squeezed his arm when they asked him to sit in at poker. It was the obnoxious apron string, the first of the many compulsions she would exert upon him if he gave in. Not that she was not a nice bit of a woman, healthy and strapping, and good to look upon, also a very excellent dancer, but that she was a woman with all a woman's desire to rope him with her apron strings, and tie him hand and foot for the branding. Better poker. Besides, he liked poker as well as he did dancing. He resisted the pull on his arm by the mere negative mass of him, and said, I sort of feel a hankering to give you all a flutter. Again came the pull on his arm. She was trying to pass the apron string around him. For the fraction of an instant he was a savage, dominated by the wave of fear and murder that rose up in him. For that infinitesimal space of time he was to all purposes a frightened tiger filled with rage and terror at the apprehension of the trap. Had he been no more than a savage, he would have leapt wildly from the place, or else sprung upon her and destroyed her. But in that same instant there stirred in him the generations of discipline by which man had become an inadequate social animal. Tact and sympathy strove with him, and he smiled with his eyes into the virgin's eyes as he said, You all go and get some grub. I ain't hungry. And we'll dance some more by and by. The night's young yet. Go to it, old girl. He released his arm, and thrust her playfully on the shoulder, at the same time turning to the poker players. Take off the limit, and I'll go you all. Limit's the roof, said Jack Kearns. Take off the roof. The players glanced at one another, and Kearns announced, The roof's off. Elam Harnish dropped into the waiting chair, started to pull out his gold sack, and changed his mind. The virgin pouted a moment, then followed in the wake of the other dancers. I'll bring you a sandwich, daylight, she called back over her shoulder. He nodded. She was smiling her forgiveness. He had escaped the apron string, and without hurting her feelings too severely. Let's play markers, he suggested. Hips do everlastingly clutter up the table. If it's agreeable to you all? I'm willing, answered Al Campbell. Et mine run at 500. Mine too, answered Harnish, while the others stated the values they put on their own markers, French Louis, the most modest, issuing his at $100 each. In Alaska, at that time, there were no rascals, and no tin horn gamblers. Games were conducted honestly, and men trusted one another. A man's word was as good as his gold in the blower. A marker was a flat, oblong composition chip worth, perhaps, a cent. But when a man betted a marker in a game, and said it was worth $500, it was accepted as worth $500. Whoever won it knew that the man who issued it would redeem it with $500 worth of dust weighed out on the scales. The markers being of different colors, there was no difficulty in identifying the owners. Also, in that early Yukon day, no one dreamed of playing table stakes. A man was good in a game for all that he possessed, no matter where his possessions were, or what was their nature. Harnish cut and got the deal. At this good augury, and while shuffling the deck, he called to the barkeepers to set up the drinks for the house. As he dealt the first card to Dan McDonald, on his left, he called out, Get down to the ground, you all, Malamutes, Huskies, and Siwash Perps. Get down and dig in. Tighten up them traces. Put your weight into the harness and bust the breast bands. Whoop-la! Yo! We're off and bound for hell and breakfast. And I tell you all clear and plain there's going to be stiff grades and fast going tonight before we win to that same lady. And somebody's going to bump. Hard. Once started, it was a quiet game, with little or no conversation, though all about the players the place was a roar. Elam Harnish had ignited the spark. More and more miners dropped into the tivoli and remained. When burning daylight went on the tier, no man cared to miss it. The dancing floor was full. Owing to the shortage of women, many of the men tied bandana handkerchiefs around their arms in token of femininity and danced with other men. All the games were crowded, and the voices of the men talking at the long bar and grouped about the stove were accompanied by the steady click of chips and the sharp whir, rising and falling, of the roulette ball. All the materials of a proper Yukon night were at hand and mixing. The luck at the table varied monotonously, no big hands being out. As a result, high play went on with small hands, though no play lasted long. A filled straight belonging to French Louis gave him a pot of 5,000 against two sets of threes held by Campbell and Kearns. One pot of $800 was won by a pair of trays on a showdown. And once Harnish called Kearns for $2,000 on a cold steal. When Kearns laid down his hand it showed a bobtail flush, while Harnish's hand proved that he had had the nerve to call on a pair of tens. But at 3 in the morning the big combination of hands arrived. It was the moment of moments that men wait weeks for in a poker game. The news of it tingled over the Tivoli. The onlookers became quiet. The men farther away ceased talking and moved over to the table. The players deserted the other games, and the dancing floor was forsaken, so that all stood at last, 50 and more, in a compact and silent group, around the poker table. The high betting had begun before the draw, and still the high betting went on, with the draw not in sight. Kearns had dealt, and French Louis had opened the pot with one marker in his case $100. Campbell had merely enid, but Elam Harnish, Corning next, had tossed in $500, with the remark to MacDonald that he was letting him in easy. MacDonald, glancing again at his hand, put in 1,000 in markers. Kearns, debating a long time over his hand, finally saw. It then cost French Louis $900 to remain in the game, which he contributed after a similar debate. It cost Campbell likewise $900 to remain and draw cards, but to the surprise of all he saw the 900 and raised another 1,000. You all are on the grade at last, Harnish remarked, as he saw the 1,500 and raised 1,000 in turn. Elon breakfast's sure on top this divide, and you all had best look out for bustin' harness. Before that same lady accompanied MacDonald's markers for 2,000 and for an additional $1,000 raise. It was at this stage that the players sat up and knew beyond peradventure that big hands were out. Though their features showed nothing, each man was beginning unconsciously to tense. Each man strove to appear his natural self, and each natural self was different. Hal Campbell affected his customary cautiousness. French Louis betrayed interest. MacDonald retained his whole-souled benevolence, though it seemed to take on a slightly exaggerated tone. Kearns was coolly dispassionate and noncommittal, while Elam Harnish appeared as quizzical and jocular as ever. $11,000 were already in the pot, and the markers were heaped in a confused pile in the center of the table. I ain't go no more markers, Kearns remarked plaintively. He'd best begin I. O-O-U's. Glad you're going to stay, was MacDonald's cordial response. I ain't stayed yet. I've got 1,000 in already. How's it stand now? It'll cost you 3,000 for a look-in, but nobody will stop you from raising. Raise hell. You must think I got a pat like yourself. Kearns looked at his hand. But I'll tell you what I'll do, Mac. I've got a hunch, and I'll just see that 3,000. He wrote the sum on a slip of paper, signed his name, and consigned it to the center of the table. French Louis became the focus of all eyes. He fingered his cards nervously for a space. Then, with a wygar, I got not one little bit hunch, he regretfully tossed his hand into the discards. The next moment the 100-and-odd pairs of eyes shifted to Campbell. I won't hump you, Jack, he said, contenting himself with calling the requisite 2,000. The eyes shifted to Harnish, who scribbled on a piece of paper and shoved it forward. I'll just let you all know this ain't no Sunday school society of philanthropy, he said. See you, Jack, and I raise you 1,000. Here's where you all get action on your pat, Mac. Actions what I fatten on, and I lift another 1,000, was McDonald's rejoinder. Till got that hunch, Jack? I still got the hunch. Kearns fingered his cards a long time. Andy, I'll play it, but you've got to know how I stand. There's my steamer, the Bella, worth 20,000, if she's worth an ounce. There's 60 Mile with 5,000 in stock on the shelves. And you know I got a sawmill coming in. It's at Linderman now, and the SCO is building. Am I good? Dig in, you're sure good, was Daylight's answer. Andy, while we're about it, I may mention casual that I got 20,000 in max safe there, and there's 20,000 more in the ground on Moosehide. You know the ground, Campbell. Is they that all in the dirt? There sure is, Daylight. How much does it cost now? Kearns asked. 2,000 to see. We'll sure hump you if you all come in, Daylight warned him. It's an almighty good hunch, Kern said, adding his slip for 2,000 to the growing heap. Can feel her crawling up and down my back. I ain't got a hunch, but I got a tolerable likable hand, Campbell announced, as he slid in his slip. But it's not a Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.